appreciate that you're listening today to Living on Purpose. My name is Lynn, your host, Mog or Margot Hesthammer, Mog to her friends. And she's a teacher of adults in transition, helping them to self-remember and find a fit in the workplace.
It feels like the subject of attention has been kind of one of my primary focuses for so long that it's hard to remember quite where or how I got so possessed with exploring it. In a way, it's kind of become my bottom line. It's where I orient from, or it's a frame of reference for me. As I was just mentioning to you, I teach 3-week workshops for people in career transitions. And one of the first things I always say to them is, you get paid for your attention. Whatever you're doing at work, yeah, you're getting paid for your attention. Attention skills, to me, are the foundational skills for any other. If you can't harness your attention, if you can't have some attention on what your attention is doing and harness it in some way, you really can't live with intention. Mm-hmm. You have to have some way of managing, harnessing, and monitoring what your attention is up to. I think one of the first things that I remember where this notion started coming to mind was I was cycling, and I was noticing that wherever my eyes went, my bike seemed to follow. And if I saw myself turning left, my bike just seemed to turn left. If I saw myself turning right, and I started experimenting with the turns that were difficult. It's always easier to turn right because I'm right dominant than left. And that if I actually visualized first and let my attention kind of draw the track mentally, mm-hmm, that it was much easier for my body to do it. It was just a very mundane kind of thing that I was playing with while I was cycling. But gradually the notion started taking form for me that attention was such a primary element in our experience of reality, that wherever we give our attention, we're making something real, we're bringing something into focus. Wherever we withhold attention, especially if we're withholding it involuntarily or unconsciously more, we tend to leave that part of our experience in an unreal state. As I speak, I'm thinking more psychologically, of course. Mm-hmm. We are predisposed to reject certain experiences, to defend against certain experiences. Mm-hmm. As long as we're not having any attention on that, we kind of live in a very patterned way. We live in the way that our defense system sort of sets us up to live. And we don't have that, even the awareness, desire, or capacity to make ourselves real in those areas. But we suffer for that too. Mm-hmm. I think that's where some of the deepest loneliness is that we experience, is where we've just really stayed out of touch with whole realms of our experience of who we are. The most challenging always is meditation. I've been a meditator. I was going to say I've been a struggling meditator forever. I find that any way that I can come to a still place, any way that I can somehow set the stage so that I am curious and open about what's going on in my present moment. So I use meditation to come to the still place. I also use a process that a school that I'm part of calls inquiry, personal inquiry, and so a lot of writing as well. I write towards myself as much as I do in sitting. And that's a ongoing challenge because life is always buzzing along and we're almost always in an agitated or semi-agitated state most of the time, and we stay busy and semi-agitated most of the time because it's the best defense there is. Yeah, and it's also very habitual. We get into energy zones, I find. If you've been in a kind of active state through most of your day, you don't just shift gears automatically when you get home. I think everyone knows that feeling. You feel like you're still circling, like a dog circling, yeah, waiting to land, and you just can't land immediately. Having some attention on those moments is the first step. Until you notice that you're in an activity zone or a speed zone of some kind, until you actually notice it, you can't act with any intention. You're caught, you're stuck, sort of, you're inside it. But once you've got that little envelope of noticing that gets you a little bit out of it, a little bit distant from it, then you have opportunity to notice, oh yeah, I'm doing that. and also to remember what it is that will help you get out of that zone into a quieter place, connect with yourself in a deeper level, which I think we're really hungry for most of the time. Why do we have so much mind chatter? Why do we have a critical, harsh voice inside our heads that's constantly nattering and nagging at us? We are constituted psychologically to stay a little bit on the run most of the time. Part of it is the voice of the superego. I'm using the term superego just because it's the original term that Freud coined. But if you're alone with yourself for a time and you haven't been really holding up a mirror to what's going on or paying attention, once you do start paying attention, you notice that there's a very critical voice that most of us have to live with and endure through most of our lives. Not to make that bad, because I think that voice was critical for our survival when we were little. This is going to get into a psychological discussion. It's hard to be alone with that voice, and I think most people stay busy so that they can outrun it. Mm-hmm. I think that activity keeps us a little bit numb and a little bit out of range of whatever's going on inside that might be sad, depressing, hateful, angry, despairing, frustrated, just generally hungry for something we don't know what we're hungry for. Mm-hmm. Like, there is so much going on that we try to live at the tip of the iceberg, I think, most of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's a buzzy, frothy, sort of agitated state that isn't ultimately satisfying at all. It's kind of like, the way I always see it is always grabbing a fresh stick of gum and spitting out the old one and grabbing a fresh stick and spitting out the old one, because that experience at that level is stale very quickly. Sure. But we still want the fresh taste. So, you know, we get into consumerism of every possible variety. And I think the culture is absolutely addicted to consumerism because it's the fresh hit, you know, the instant action. When really what's going on is we're hungry for the action in our own show, but we're very disconnected from it. And so any technique, any activity that puts us back in touch with what's really going on with our own action, it's not going to be the thing that makes us jump for joy. It's not going to be immediately like buying a new top, you know, or something like that. It's not going to be that kind of a hit, but it's that sense of connecting with ourselves that is, it's just so deeply soothing in a certain other way, you know.
When you get that good feeling inside yourself, sometimes it's associated with acquiring a new object. I've really enjoyed those feelings that are like that. It's sort of that warm feeling, but it's connected with a connection I've made with myself, a realization I've had, something that is free of regret.
The thing about that feeling that you've come into alignment somehow, that you've actually landed in the center of your truth of that moment, It's not always a happy thing. Like, sometimes it's just a realization that, oh, I'm feeling rejected right now, actually. That's what's going on right now. I was walking down the road. I saw someone I know. I waved. They didn't wave back. Immediately, I get agitated. I find myself ahead of myself. Oh, I'm already down at the market now buying what I'm going to buy. But if I notice, oh, I'm agitated. Why am I agitated? If I just notice that, then I have a chance. Oh, I'm agitated because so-and-so didn't wave back at me. Now, my rational mind can say, well, no doubt they didn't see me. They don't have anything against me. Probably they just didn't see me. But my emotional side is going, I've been rejected. I'm feeling rejected. And it's such a small thing, I know. But there's a moment when that hits where you've landed in the middle of what's real for you in that moment. And it's so, God, I keep looking for the right word. I just keep thinking of landing. Yeah. It's so satisfying. Yeah, you're grounded in that moment. You haven't turned away from anything. And that's what we're doing most of the time. We're resisting our experience so much of the time. Then you go, oh, and what I notice, I feel rejected. Okay, what immediately comes up that's now sort of comical but was really important while I was unconscious is, oh, my image of myself doesn't like that. I'm not the kind of person who's supposed to get rejected. Oh, yeah, okay, so I'm also carrying a picture of myself, I notice, of someone as being someone who's not supposed to get rejected, right? Yeah. And that's interesting, too. as long as I'm unconscious and sort of on automatic, that will be running the show. That will be what turns me away from the experience in the moment.
And it really hooks into our rules, our unconscious set of rules of not only what we need to do or should do, but also what we expect of others. When you say hello to somebody, there's a pretty specific response that's going to fit for you, that's either going to confirm your feeling about yourself or really challenge your feeling about yourself. I mean, that's a very sensitive place to be. And it can be such an extreme as you ask a question, you don't get the response you're expecting, so you ask it again because you just can't imagine life going on without getting the response you expected.
And there we are, really being at the effect of what's outside us,
yeah,
and tuned more to what's coming in from outside and kind of being really caught up in a formula interaction. And hey, you're not playing by the rules here. This isn't working right, you know, no fair. Ideally, of course, if we could stay tuned to just what's actually happening with ourselves, there would be, oh, I'm disappointed, or I'm having an experience of disappointment. Okay. Actually, that's just my experience in the moment because someone from outside didn't want to validate whatever I was holding up. And I doubt that their action had anything to do with me, actually. It speaks more of them.
Yeah.
But how often are we going to be this conscious in a moment, right? To have attention, even if it's after the fact, to have attention on the reality of that, even to recognize, oh, so someone didn't hold up their end of a formula interaction, of a classic sort of formula interaction that we have socially. Should that be something that puts a cloud over my day for the next 3 hours, you know, or that I carry even into the next 3 weeks of my life? It's craziness if it does. But if we're not tuning at all to what's going on there, we'll just have a reaction. We are absolutely stimulus response machines at that level when we're not aware of what's going on in a given moment.
I have this ongoing habit of doing things a little bit differently than people expect so that it will wake us all up. Yeah, like people, you know, are in that unconscious mode of extending the right hand and shaking hands. I will either go right into a hug if I feel so inclined. Yeah, fairly careful around that, depending on how I feel and depending how I think the other person's going to receive it. And sometimes that's not going to work for me, depending. I also extend the left hand. And sometimes I have stuff in my right hand, which gives an excuse to somebody. But quite often, I just extend my left hand and it really throws people off. It immediately wakes them up. You were just saying that you get really drawn out on the psychological aspect of all of this, but I think that's appropriate because that's a big part of how we try to figure ourselves out. Walking down the street after somebody hasn't waved to you, we live there.
We spend so much of our lives in reaction to something or on the run. I just call it on the run in general, often from many, many things at the same time. I think it's a really ultimately very unbearable way to live. I think it's suffering. I think it's the essence of suffering in many ways, to always be trying to outrun your background roar, whatever it may be composed of. And the relief of just coming to a stop and letting it be and exploring it just with a kind of open, curious attitude and actually allowing whatever emotion needs to come up to come up too. It's another social thing. We feel so strongly about what experiences are good. We have such strong biases around the experiences that we think we should be having and the ones we think we shouldn't be having. And they're very tied up with our picture of ourselves and who we are. And it's a sad bias because we miss, there's so much richness in every kind of emotion. It's a very, very different feeling to be completely open to a moment of sadness or grief or anger, and to be inviting it and allowing it, than it is to be in that state of resistance where you're basically on the run from it. But you know how they say, what we resist persists. Whenever you're actually trying to hold something at bay, you're really holding it in place just as it is. It doesn't have a chance to move, to evolve, to dissipate, to just do what it would do. If you think of emotion being energy in motion, right? Mm-hmm. We damn it. Whenever there's a judgment from inside that says, no, this is not the kind of thing I feel, or this is not the kind of thing I should be feeling, we spend so much of our energy just going, no, 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 you know, and resisting in every direction. And really, there's a tremendous amount of life force, energy bound up in that process of resistance all the time. And even to take one moment in a day where our intention is to just be with whatever's going on, mm-hmm. just to be with whatever's happening in us in that moment, it's huge. It's a start, you know, it's a place to start from. My hope is that eventually the habit of tuning to, of looking towards instead of turning away, will be the main habit. I know it's not yet. I know that the resistance is still calling the shots in many, many cases. It requires a certain amount of orchestration. You have to have some quiet. You have to have a place where you can be, where nobody's going to be interrupting you moment to moment, particularly for a real inquiry where you're following the thread of your experience and trying to really allow everything that's there. It requires, for me anyway, silence, no background music, usually unplugged phone or definitely the answering machine's on and the volume's off. I can't just do it all the time. I say that, and I think that there is a way where you can have the intention that you're going to stay tuned to your experience moment to moment and to what's the truth moment to moment in just a quick way. Oh, yeah, rejection. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, disappointment. Oh, joy, this, that, feels good, feels bad, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a way that you can bring that into a daily practice, too, of combining it with whatever you're doing. It takes really valuing it. I think that there is a point or a discovery that people make at a certain point when they really are willing to be with themselves and be with their experience, where the relief of touching in, the relief of just touching in on what's so, is so hugely rewarding that you kind of get hungry for that more than anything else, you know? And I think that people have to be at that place in order to do the work that they're gonna have to do to live with that kind of attention on what's so, on what's going on. The reward has to be felt.
Yeah, there has to be a concrete kind of feeling about it. Mm-hmm. All right, so a lot of what we've been talking about is people's interaction with themselves. So how do you take that relationship and set it into place with interaction with other people and preserve that intactness with the attention to what's going on without being irrevocably thrown into a vortex of so many entanglements in your mind and your emotions that you're almost paralyzed? You know, how do you keep the spontaneity in the attention and the disappointment out of the subtleties of the interactions?
I think that there are times when it's just not possible to have the full Monty of an interaction until you're later sort of settled and thinking of it. There are ways in which you can do your part to make the kind of interaction that is going to be as rewarding as possible on both sides. I think the obvious first thing is really, really learning to listen, learning to give real attention to other people. Something happens. It's an interesting thing to really listen. When you really give full attention, it's actually very healthy. Your blood pressure goes down mm-hmm. because you've lost that clamoring inside, that agitated state that's just waiting for your turn to speak, you know. It's a good way to monitor it. You mm-hmm. can tell. You get deeply relaxed when you're absolutely giving full attention over there, really tuning over there. What happens often is if a person who you're in a difficult interaction with feels really heard, they start to relax too. Something happens. We go around feeling invisible so much of the time, and we're all dealing with a narcissistic wound that, you know, comes from just the earliest times of our lives. We all feel invisible in some ways. And so when somebody really, really listens, there's, I think, a natural healing that happens in that interaction, unless the other person is just so winged off that they're in a totally reactive state and they can't even tune to the fact that they're being tuned to, you know. But it seems like that's really the place to start always, is to listen, also to monitor your own mind chatter, because we're always judging and criticizing, and not just ourselves, but everyone around us. It's the function of that part of our mind. So to notice when we're doing that and bring our attention back to the person and just try to give them as open a forum as possible, but also be tuning to our own signals and be aware of if we're feeling violated or feeling that an interaction is getting abusive, to be able to draw a line and say, I can't continue the conversation, or I need some time. I'm in a reactive state right now, or I'm feeling anger. I'm feeling this or that right now. It's got to be the most challenging thing. I mean, it's much easier to be with yourself all by yourself. I still think that there are some very, very basic tools, and always the first one is listening, in my experience. What you give your attention to is what you make real. And when you really give attention to someone else, they feel real in your presence. And I think everyone has had that feeling of being very thinned out around certain people. The kind of attention that they give you is so automatic or unconscious. Well, you can always feel when someone's not there. It makes you antsy and anxious and wanting to get away, or it certainly does me. You feel thinned out in their presence, because when we're in an interaction, we're kind of depending on one another to mirror each other. And if it's not happening, you feel diminished. You literally feel diminished in someone's presence. Doesn't matter how unadult that may sound, we do. We're interdependent in that way.
Okay, Mog, in your epic work of writing here, we have something called the story. What's that all about?
In the manuscript, the first story I begin with is the belief that we're separate entities, of course, and that many of the storylines of our life are based on the idea that we are separate beings in little body bags going around having interactions with other little body bags and so on. Aside from that, also just the realization that the way we make meaning is to narratize or to make stories about our experience. So I'm using the term story in a really broad sense. Newton's physics is a story. It's a story that's still good enough to build bridges, but it's been far eclipsed by, you know, quantum mechanics and so on. Whether you're talking about a scientific theory or a belief or an opinion or even an attitude, you could filter out a storyline from all of that. And we get really attached to our stories. We get very positional about our stories. And we take our stories for truth. And I think it's both a loss of innocence and a very important experience to have a really profound realization that we're walking around with a lot of fiction, that we're walking around with a lot of made-up ideas, stories about life itself, about our own experiences, about our past particularly, and the stories that create reactive beings out of us and tend to program our futures, and that there are more and less productive ways of looking at stories. In fact, there's a new kind of therapy called narrative therapy out right now that I don't know that much about it, but I think that it's partly designed to help you challenge the old stories that are just have lain fallow and have been exerting quiet influence for years and years. I was actually teaching a class one day, and we have one day where we talk about the paradigms that we're working with, the stories that we're telling about our experience. I had a little sign on my ghetto blaster. I play music sometimes. I have a little ghetto blaster that has a sign on the top that said, CD player is broken. And one of my students said, well, how do you know your CD player is broken? And I said, oh, it broke years ago. I've had that sign on it for about 3 years. It won't play. It doesn't work. Well, how do you know? I said, well, I tried it, you know, I tried making it work and it doesn't work, it won't play. And the guy started pestering me about it and I started getting irritated because I had a story about this thing. And he said, well, tell you what, Mog, what if I bring in a cleaner CD tomorrow and we give it a shot? And I said, sure, you can do anything, I'm fine with it, but it's broken. The next day he came in. He didn't even try the CD cleaner because I had a CD that was had been sitting there forever. I pushed the play button and it worked. To this day, I don't know how I got that story, but I hadn't used my CD player, part of the Ghetto Blaster, for 3 or 4 years. You know how some play buttons have the play and pause on the same button? I may just have pressed pause, thinking I pressed play. But I walked around with that story, and it was so funny because it came up right on the day when we were talking about these things. Yeah. I mean, anyone who's grown up with more than one sibling in a family knows. It's like you've had totally different families.
Oh, yeah.
It's just ridiculous how many stories we have. Having some awareness on that, but more profoundly, having an awareness of the storyline that you're packing in a moment that's affecting you in the moment, recognizing whether or not it's outdated, mm-hmm. whether it's something you could change for something more productive, whether it's causing you some suffering, you know, in that moment, or causing you to see the world in a very untruthful way, or yourself in an untruthful way. So it's just another kind of area where there's skillful means, mm-hmm. having some attention on the story, having some attention on the position you're in right now. If I'm facing this way, everything I see is very, I see green, I see red, I see trees, I see pavement and so on. It's very clear, it's very real, it's very true. So that's my, but that's not what you're seeing, mm-hmm. you know? You're facing the other direction. And we forget that when we're having disputes with people and arguments with people. Everyone's got a different spoke on the wheel mm-hmm. and a very strong storyline to support it, you know? So I think that was a big part of it. Staying tuned to our cherished positions on things.
I don't know who to credit this idea for, and you may be aware of it, is when you become aware of a belief that you've been carrying around a long time in your knapsack, that you make a distinction between what you believed up until now. So you can actually phrase it like that. Until yesterday, I believed this about myself. Today, I am open to the idea of a new perception of myself in that way. And then that way your mind can accept it in a better way than saying, oh, that never worked for me, or, you know, I'll always be like that, or that's the story of my life, which can really pin you down.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree. We live very confined by our storylines, our life storylines, and by our ideal images of ourselves, our ideal pictures of how we're supposed to show up in the world, how we're supposed to be seen. That's another one, if you're wanting to get, I think that's very useful, if you're wanting to get at the truth of a moment, your particular reality in a moment, in an as undistorted a way as possible, to just say, okay, what ideal image of myself is running in this moment? Because we always have one. Yeah. We always have mm-hmm. some ego ideal that is telling us who we are or should be or want to be in a given moment. It's like noticing the storyline, noticing the self-image that's running immediately frees us from the trap of them. Yeah. Oh yeah, in this situation, I wanted to appear as the very mature, balanced person who has a lot of equanimity, not easily thrown. Oh right, that's why I wasn't admitting I was feeling a raging jealousy right now, or high anxiety, or as soon as an experience conflicts with any idealized picture we have of ourselves, we're doomed. We're again caught up in an experience of resistance, I suppose, mm-hmm. trying to uphold a false picture of ourselves. We're looking a little bit at the language of the body. If we want to live authentic lives, if we want to be truly in touch with the reality in our moments, that the body is a huge ally. The body serves up experience whole in various physical feelings and so on. There's a wonderful old book by a guy named Eugene Gendlin called Focusing. He'd been a psychotherapist for years and years and years, and discovered that some people change in psychotherapy and some people didn't. And to his great dismay, after 20 years of practice, realized it had very little to do with him. And that what happened for some people was that they were able to access what he calls a felt sense of a given situation. In other words, they were in touch with their body's take on a situation, the physical qualities of it. These people had a kind of a natural back and forth communication with their bodies that enabled them to get to the truth of a situation, to the truth of what their experience was in a moment, more readily than people who obviously are stuck in their heads. And what Gendlin did was he very carefully monitored these people and interviewed them and found out how they did it, which was then presented in about 6 simple steps. So I highly recommend that book for anyone who wants to stay in touch with their body. But what he does is he invites you to go down into the forward part of your body, anywhere from your throat to your abdomen kind of area. One of the best examples he uses is to think of someone you know. Do you want to try this? Okay, so think of someone you know quite well, and then close your eyes for a moment and go down into the forward part of your body and just get a sense of how they feel, how they inhabit you, the visceral, actual sensations that you have. So it could be warm, smooth, spiky, prickly, creamy. Have you got any kind of word that you could give us that would describe the person?
Like a beach, like coral, you know, really broken up sand and coral and pebbles on a beach. A really condensed, stubbly.
Okay, now think of someone quite different. Someone who you wouldn't say was in the same. Okay, do the same thing. Go down into your body and take a moment and just notice what sensations, physical sensations come up.
This person feels more like constellations, like where there's a lot of stars but a lot of space in between. Physical words. Like if you were holding something that had air going through it. Porous, yeah, porous.
Interesting. And even still, we're not quite getting at a feeling that you're having in your body. If you played with it for a little while, the key is to notice the actual physical, whether there's pressure or ease or smoothness or prickliness or... I know you had a sense, definitely, of who you were.
The first one, I probably felt more in my chest, like breath being held.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, and the second person would be more like an openness in the belly.
Great. Yeah. That's taking it to actual your feelings.
Okay.
And that's and it takes a little getting used to. We tend often to start off with a description that's a little bit more mental or visual.
Sure.
And most of us have a visual that goes with it. The visuals are great, but you want to bring them in later because the visuals are like imagination and they can take off, get a little ungrounded with it, so we can lose the original. What I like about that whole notion of just intentionally going down to tune to what the body is saying in a given moment takes us out of our heads. And the idea is you dip in and out. Attention can't be focused too harshly in any area for too long. So you allow it to dip in and out. And each time you go back, you notice if that feeling is the same or if there's a shift. And there's often a shift because a felt sense of something with attention on it, it will kind of come unpacked. And there may be other elements inside it. It's a very neat way to be in touch. I use it with writing. If I'm writing and I feel like something is not quite right, I'll get a twist in my gut. It'll usually mean that I've strayed from what was essential or truthful to something that was clever or a nice turn of phrase that, you know, sort of seduced me off my path. And there's a kink, a definite kink that I'm very familiar with, that will tell me, no, not good, get back on track. Whereas a little flutter, you know, the belly fluttering a little bit could just mean that I'm excited and a little bit scared, but we're on the scent of something, and that's exciting, it's okay. It's just the fact that the body can't lie. As long as the body has the data, relevant data for that given moment, it will not tell a lie. We've always got a barometer. We've always got something that we can rely on. It's also a huge relief to get out of our heads, forget what I should be thinking, forget how I want to see myself and all of that stuff that's going on upstairs. What's really happening? You know, how am I really feeling about this? Oh, I feel squashed. Or, oh, I feel really lightened by this or whatever. Mm. One of our best allies for getting to what's real.
When I was making all that room in my life 2 years ago and then found CHLY as I had opened to a creative challenge, made space for that. In that process of clearing out activities that no longer inspired me, I very much became aware of my body that way that you were describing, because when people would suggest something that would turn me back into that direction, I felt like I was going to be sick, and I felt a distinct wrench in my chest. Like, it was very clear to me. That very quickly became my barometer, as you say, a clear indication. I didn't have to second guess that. That was really clear to me.
That's great. And I think it's really important for our psychic well-being and integrity and so on to be tuning that way, because a lot of people just override body signals and stay. A lot of people think they're playing it safe when they stay in miserable jobs. And I heard a really amazing statistic. First of all, the number one killer in North America is heart disease, and that most people suffer their first major heart attack between 8 and 9 a.m. on a Monday morning going to jobs that they hate. So they sort of think they're playing it safe at one level by staying in a quote-unquote secure job. But it's not safe in the end at all. If we're not tuning to what our body's saying and our psyche in general, we're not in good shape.
You were mentioning jobs that we hate, that the people, a lot of people do that. That's almost taken for granted that people don't like their jobs. And when I was leaving work on Friday, I said to the people I work with, you know, we were talking about Tuesday, like there'll be more mail after a long weekend, and I have my show that day, so it means really being there, being very present, being there in good time, getting the work done in time that I can show up for Living on Purpose. I said, I'm really looking forward to that. I can't wait till Tuesday. They shake their heads in wonder, but they know that I really like doing the job. Mm-hmm. It's hard not to be seen as sarcastic when you say, I can't wait to get back, right? That's how it would be interpreted. How sad that it's unusual that someone, and I'm so glad it gets to me, feels that way about what I'm doing with all of my time. I very rarely do things that I don't want to do, and everything seems quite well coordinated at this point in my life, and I'm really thankful for that. I find that if there is something I don't want to do, usually I don't have to do it in an easy way, not in a resistant way.
Wonderful. You also bring up something that I think is really a pervasive cultural storyline that, if it goes unchallenged, itself can create a lot of misery in the workplace. And that is, there's a book out called Flow. I don't know if you've come across it. Yeah, The Psychology of Optimal Enjoyment or something. I can't quite remember the subtitle, but it's a study of enjoyment and the elements of enjoyment. Interestingly, he points out that one of the most important cultural storylines that prevents people from enjoying themselves at work is the belief that time spent at work is like time subtracted from my life, that work is an impingement. That belief is in the back of most people's minds, and it's supported a lot by the media and advertising and so on. We get sold a lot of work relief stuff, and consumerism in general is work relief. You know, you've spent five miserable days at work, now go out and buy something and cheer up. I mean, this is kind of pathetic, but it's interesting. If that storyline is unchallenged, most people will not enjoy the perfect fit for them at work. Yeah. You can have the most perfect fit, the best job for you that there is, but if you've got that belief forming a little cloud over your head on a Monday morning, you're not going to go in and enjoy your work. Mm-hmm. That's part of it too, I think, having some attention on that, but also on the fact that enjoyment is not what most people think either. Real enjoyment, they say, comes from that state of total engagement. When you're totally, totally engaged, your mind can only be in one place at a time, right? You do not have room to be worrying about whatever problems may be going on in the back of your life. If you're fully present, you actually get relief from anything else that may be causing distress. There may be things that are pending that you can't do anything about. Being engaged is the thing that gives us relief. And it also, because self-efficacy and all of the kinds of general effectiveness and mastery always are supported by being present. I mean, that's where mastery develops, is when we're fully present with what we're doing. That state of engagement is hugely satisfying also, because we come out feeling like we have more mastery afterwards. And we lose self-consciousness. We forget to go, how do I look? How do I look? How do I look? We're not worrying about what other people are thinking of us. And so when people don't presence themselves from work and don't allow themselves to get into that really fully engaged state, they're ripping themselves off for the potential enjoyment in work, really.
Earlier on, you were talking about writing towards yourself in terms of clearing the way, I suppose, to find out what's happening for you in the moment. Journal writing is a very effective tool for kind of clearing the decks. I know that part of the reason I've used it in the last few years especially is just getting through to what's really happening. When you clear out all that clutter of the thoughts and the details, even making a list of all the things on your mind, then you can get beyond that. And I think journal writing is more accessible as a tool because you can make up your own rules about it, more so than when you feel pressured to write a novel or even a short story. If you're just journal writing, there's less pressure and more room to move around all those reference points that one has in one's mind.
I think that's really true. The expression writing towards yourself is from a book by a man named Don McKay that I read some years ago. For what I call inquiry, journal writing is the best thing I know. It's, as you say, there's no rules, no regulations. You can be completely impressionistic. Sometimes I'll just write down what's happening in the weather, actually. I often start with the sky. I'll often just start with thin, gray, mottled sky and something or other that often, because it sort of resonates with the mood that I'm in or is partly staining the mood that I'm in or causing the mood that I'm in, wherever that might lead, just to use it as an exploration for what's happening in the moment, how that might be resonating with other moments or with what's kind of going on in the background of my mind with some of the bigger problems. There's a trap with it that I think is really important to avoid, and that is we tend to want to explore what's challenging and difficult for us. And there's a kind of writing that I really try to guard against. It's a kind that I used to do, writing for grim satisfaction, where you're kind of reporting on a situation, and really what you're doing is telling the story about a situation in a way that ends up making you feel right or somehow exonerated, or it's a sort of cheat and it's an easy one to drift into. Mm-hmm. Not that I think that there's anything wrong with a rant or a good vent on paper is really good, but if most writing turns into that kind of whiny reporting for grim satisfaction, then you have kind of gone 180 degrees in the wrong direction from where you were hoping to be. Mm-hmm. So the idea of really exploring in the exact moment also what your process of writing is bringing up for you. So having a little bit of attention on your immediate process and noticing if you're using it to shore up some perfect picture of yourself or some story that you're really committed to or whatever. I think that that's a part of the skillful means for using journal writing in a truthful way, or for using your natural curiosity in a way that will keep things opening instead of the open and shut case of a story. And also, if I am writing for the purpose of venting or getting rid of toxic emotion of some kind, getting it up and out, I lately have just taken to making sure that I pop out of it and the last line that I leave is a very positive one in some way, mm-hmm. or an encouraging one, something that's inviting me to get my head up again and, mm-hmm. and look at the day so that I don't get stuck. Always when we're dealing with difficult emotion or difficult experiences, there's the desire to touch in and be truthful and real with them. And there's always the danger of re-traumatizing in some way or just deepening an already deepened groove in our psychic terrain. You know, if most of us have one or two emotions that we feel easily and others that are harder to access, mm-hmm. and it's the ones we feel easily that we tend to go to, that we're sort of spring-loaded to go yeah. to. If anger is really easy, if it's really easy for you to get angry, then you might not have got to the sadness that's underneath it, or whatever emotion, the loneliness or whatever. Or if sadness is really easy to go to, you may just find yourself falling back into the hole of sadness all the time and not getting at the rage that's mm-hmm. under that or whatever. So there's dangers and skillful means, I think, in quote unquote writing towards yourself. It's like anything, if we're on automatic and not very conscious and not having some attention on what we're doing, we will just retell our stories. Mm-hmm. Sort of sitting beside an experience mm-hmm. without going right into the whole of it, but sitting beside it enough that we've got a good strong taste of it and being able to explore it from there, but still keep our head above water, kind of. I liken it a little to wine tasting. Putting your whole nose in the glass, you're getting the full aroma and all of that, maybe even rolling it on your tongue, but you're not swallowing it all because you're going to lose your sense of discrimination very quickly. Huh. Experience tasting, maybe.
What's up today? This is Corbin Keep, the wild cellist from Bowen Island, and you are listening to Living on Purpose. Go for it, folks. There's only now.
There's nothing's gonna bring me down.